Welcome. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's a real pleasure to welcome you to tonight's edition of Headliners. We started this public forum 3 years ago as a way for you to meet with university scholars whose expertise illuminates the stories in the headlines. Every month, no matter the topic, your insightful questions and comments have demonstrated how well informed you are about current events. And I would venture a guess that probably like me, most of you are avid newspaper readers, and that you're here tonight because you're concerned by the rapid change transforming the ways we've traditionally accessed the news. Last year was the worst on record for the U.S. newspaper industry. Already hard hit by decreasing circulation and declining ad revenues, newspapers across the country laid off staff and cut editions to counter the dual effects of online competition and economic recession. In our own market, the Star Tribune filed for bankruptcy protection in January, only emerging in late September with a future that's still very unclear. Last month, Minnesota Public Radio held a day-long summit on the future of the news in response to what is characterized as a crisis in American journalism. And just this morning, it was announced that Comcast has acquired a controlling percentage of NBC Universal. Boy, are we timely, huh? What does all this mean to those of us who care deeply about quality journalism? Are the internet, cable television, and wireless communication capable of replacing the print and broadcast news we've depended on for decades? How will we receive headlines in the future? So tonight, we're very fortunate to be able to discuss these issues with one of the country's leading authorities on new media. Nora Paul came to the University of Minnesota in 2000 as the founding director of the School of Journalism's Institute for New Media Studies. This institute was created to explore the issues raised by new media for journalism and mass communications. Before accepting this post, Professor Paul served for 9 years as a faculty member in the leadership and reporting programs at the Poynter Institute, one of the country's top journalism schools dedicated to mid-career journalists. Prior to the Poynter, she served as editor for information services at the Miami Herald, where she developed one of the earliest electronic news gathering databases and started a fee-based research service for the general public. A seasoned journalist, researcher, and news librarian, she now focuses on how new channels of communication are reshaping both the medium and the message. She's published and lectured widely on the development of new media and news research, and is the author of several books on these topics, including Computer-Assisted Research, A Guide to Tapping Online Information, which is currently in its fourth edition, and I look forward to reading that. I think I better. Will you please join me in welcoming Nora Paul?
Tell you first, I'm not wearing black because I'm in mourning over the news business. It's just that it's slimming. Okay. And after Thanksgiving, I needed it. How many of you, is this your first time to come to this event? Most of you are repeats. Good. I've heard from some of the people that have come to these before that it's a terrific forum and that you all are very, very engaged in the question and answer part at the end. And so I'm really looking forward to being part of a discussion with you about what I think is one of the most critical social issues that we're all facing right now, and that is the continued viability of the news business. Why is this so important? Thomas Jefferson stated it well. Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Now, the newspaper's current business decline is not the first one caused by a new technology. During the Great Depression, plunging revenues and competition from the emerging technology of radio hurt newspapers badly. Newspaper advertising revenue fell 45% from 1929 to 1933. Hundreds of newspapers went out of business or suspended operations. And almost a third of the salaried workers in newspapers lost their jobs. Sounds kind of what's going on now. Then along came television. By the 1960s, television surpassed newspapers as the preferred source for information and news, and they became serious competitors to newspapers as the vehicle for national advertising. One of the results of this down cycle in the 1960s was the selling off of family-owned newspapers to the expanding newspaper chains. By 1977, 170 newspaper groups owned two-thirds of the 1,700 daily papers in America. Now, there was further fallout as a result of these two down cycles in the newspaper business, and that was the disappearance of competing newspapers in a single town. In 1910, nearly 60% of cities had competing daily newspapers. By 1930, that figure had fallen to 21%, and by 1971, only 2% of American cities had competing daily papers. This lack of competition raised concerns about a diminishing watchdog role for news, and that certainly sounds familiar too, doesn't it? And now there is a new disruptive technology battering the newspaper business, the internet. Will this one be the death knell for news? Early on, there was some real interesting experimentation with how this kind of digital thing that was starting to develop might play out for newspapers. Let's take a look at an early experiment in digital news, circa 1981.
Imagine, if you will, sitting down to your morning coffee, turning on your home computer to read the day's newspaper. Well, it's not as far-fetched as it may seem. In fact, both local San Francisco papers are investing a lot of money to try and get a service just like that started. Science editor Steve Newman reports on one person already using the brand new system.
17 stories up in his fashionable North Beach apartment, Richard Halloran is calling a local number that will connect him with a computer in Columbus, Ohio. Meanwhile, across town in this less-than-fashionable cubbyhole at the San Francisco Examiner, these editors are programming today's copy of the paper into that same Ohio computer. When the telephone connection between these two terminals is made, the newest form of electronic journalism lights up Mr. Halloran's television with just about everything the Examiner prints in its regular edition. That is, with the exception of pictures, ads, and the comics. Eight newspapers around the country are currently in the computer network, and within the next few weeks, three others will join in.
This is an experiment. We're trying to figure out what it's going to mean to us as editors and reporters and what it means to the home user. And we're not in it to make money. We're not going to lose a lot, but we aren't going to make much either.
Both Examiner and Chronicle began service within the last 2 weeks and printed full-page ads about it. Of the estimated 2,000 to 3,000 home computer owners in the Bay Area, the Chronicle reports over 500 have responded by sending back coupons. Even though the electronic newspaper isn't as spiffy looking as the ads imply, people using the system are excited about its potential.
With this system, we have the option not only of seeing the newspaper on the screen, but also we can copy it. So anything we're interested in, we could go back in again and copy it onto paper and save it, which I think is the future of the type of interrogation an individual will give to the newspapers.
This is only the first step in newspapers by computer. Engineers now predict the day will come when we get all our newspapers and magazines by home computer, but that's a few years off. So for the moment at least, this fellow isn't worried about being out of a job. Steve Newman, News Center 4.
Well, it takes over 2 hours to receive the entire text of the newspaper over the phone, and with an hourly use charge of $5, the new telepaper won't be much competition for the 20-cent street edition.
So, yep, 2 hours. And there was some other experimentation that went on. The company that I worked for, Knight Ritter, remember them? They used to own a lovely newspaper here in St. Paul. They started an experiment called Viewtron, which was really an early CompuServe. Back in the 80s, they were developing digitally delivered news and information really targeted to the regional area. The trouble with both of these things, though, is they required using some key appliances in your house. You had to connect your telephone to your television and then buy this sort of keyboard with Viewtron, buy a keyboard to be able to access it. So if you were using keyboard, you knocked Viewtron, you knocked out your television and you knocked out your telephone. So this predated personal computers. And by the time the technology, the appliance that really could have made this a viable sort of business, Knight Ridder had already sunk so much money into that enterprise that they, you know, really were kind of scared off of any innovation. Here is where we are now. Each year, the Project for Excellence in Journalism publishes a State of the News Media report. The lead of the 2009 report stated the newspaper industry is perilously close to free fall. We all know the statistics. Circulation is down. According to the Wall Street Journal in October, circulation at many of the largest U.S. newspapers slid sharply during the 6 months ended in September, a sign of deepening trouble for the industry. Weekday circulation for 379 U.S. dailies dropped 10.6% compared to a year earlier. It was the sharpest fall-off in more than a decade. Advertising sales are plummeting. According to the Newspaper Association of America, the first 3 months of 2009 was the worst quarter in modern history for American newspapers as advertising sales fell by an unprecedented 28.3% from the prior year. This accounted for both print and online ad sales. And you can see from this chart of the daily newspaper readership by age group from 1999 to 2008 that the trend, unfortunately, as with the others, is heading south in all of the age categories. Now, it's hard to place blame for this seemingly irreversible downward trend in all of the key indicators of a newspaper's health. Is it because Google is scooping up all the newspaper's content and making it available for free and then selling the advertising that might have gone to the newspaper? Anybody know who this is?
Craig.
Yep. Is it Craig Newmark's fault? His brainchild, Craigslist, seriously impacted one of the strongest of newspapers' revenue streams, classified advertising. Or do we just blame the rotten economy? Nationally, classified help wanted ads fell 67.4% in the first quarter of 2009. Or do we blame the newspaper chain's buying frenzy in the boom days and the resultant debt that they took on? Now, some people blame the newspapers themselves, their lack of vision. Just as the old saying goes that the railroads went under because they didn't understand they were in the transportation business, not the railroad business, so too with newspapers. They think they're in the newspaper business, not the news and information business. But the biggest problem has been the upheaval the internet has wrought on the advertising marketplace. For most of the existence of ad-supported newspapers, there was no other medium that could compete against what newspapers did very well, which was to provide local display ads, coupons, classified advertising. You couldn't provide those on television or radio or in national magazines, so newspapers had a built-in constant source of funding from the advertisers who didn't have any other choice. Excuse me. Then along came the internet. Now merchandisers could set up their own websites and offer coupons to their customers. Classified ads went to Craigslist, and help wanted ads went to Monster. The advertising-supported business model for newspapers was crumbling, and they haven't been able to replace it. And the reason the online version of the newspaper can't make money selling advertising is because on the internet, there is an infinite supply of advertising space. And if there is an infinite supply, the price goes to zero. Now, what has been, to me, I think, the worst of the fallout from this business downturn with regards to society's need for strong, independent journalism? I believe it is the decimation of the workforce in newsrooms through buyouts and layoffs. The website Paper Cuts has been tracking news layoffs in the U.S. since 2007. There have been over 14,000 this year, but the three-year total is over 47,000. And what's the impact of this? The number of reporters covering state legislatures in 2009 is down more than 30% from 2003. Between 2002 and 2006, the number of U.S. newspapers with foreign correspondents fell 30%. And investigative reporting has been hit very hard. There was a survey done by the Arizona State University of the 100 largest U.S. daily newspapers, and it showed that 37% had no full-time investigative reporters, a majority had two or fewer such reporters, and only 10% had four or more. And I think we can probably count which ones those are, Washington Post, New York Times. So without a strong workforce of trained, independent journalists, we're left with the opinion-laden and agenda-ridden comments of bloggers, for the most part. Okay, Clay Sharkey, he's a new media consultant and the author of a great book called Here Comes Everybody. And I think he sums up the situation that we're in right now really beautifully with these two statements. One, it's easier to see what's broken than what will replace it. And two, society doesn't need newspapers. What we need is journalism. So, just how will we pay for this journalism? Excuse me. One thing we know is that subscriptions have never subsidized the cost of producing the news. Was the advertising, it was always advertising or in the past, you know, more distant past, political parties or wealthy patrons. But some of the attempts to figure out a new model for news involves coming up with a fee structure for accessing newsroom-produced content. Rupert here is leading the charge. Rupert Murdoch has vowed to charge for all of the online content of his newspaper and television news channels. If we are successful, he said, we'll be followed by all media, and predicts significant revenues from charging for differentiated news online. The real fallacy in his position, however, is that he is basing it on the success of the Wall Street Journal online subscription model. The problem is the Wall Street Journal has very unique, mission-critical content that people are willing to pay for and which often have subscribers able to expense as business expense. But that's not the case with most local news content. Coverage of key stories of the day is a commodity, one easily found in a wide variety of places. Even so, there are a variety of initiatives being developed around transaction payment for news. One of them is called Journalism Online. Their idea is that publication websites powered with the Journalism Online e-commerce engine will allow customers to have easy one-stop account access common to all of the publishers' websites. This allows consumers to sign up just once to purchase annual or monthly subscriptions, day passes, or single articles from multiple publishers. The password-enabled payment system is integrated into all the members' publishers' websites, and the publishers have sole discretion over which content to charge for, how much to charge, and the manner of charging. And here's a new one, just starting up. It's still in beta, called Kachingle. It's a voluntary payment system that basically says if you would like to provide a certain amount of financial support to sites that you like, then every time you go to a site with a Kachingle medallion on it, you can designate some of your Kachingle deposit to go to that site. So essentially, it's like the old government printing office deposit account. You know, you could say, I'll spend $100 this year on media, and then you dole it out as you wish. And then, of course, Google is getting into it, too. They're working on an application called First Click Free, which will have participating publishers allow the Google crawler to index their subscription content. So do you know what I mean by that? Because lots of times the subscription content is that stuff behind a registration wall or in a database that the Google spider can't go and scoop up. So this would be an arrangement with the publishers to actually open that vault that has been kind of hidden to the Google indexing spiders. So now, This will allow users who find one of their articles through either Google News or Google Search to see the full page without requiring them to register or to subscribe. The user's first click to the content is free, but when a user clicks on additional links on the site, the publisher can show a payment or registration request. So they're trying to, you know, help facilitate that sort of registration. Now, another approach some mainstream news organizations are trying is the idea of freemium content. This works by offering basic services for free while charging a premium for advanced or special features. So, the Star Tribune Vikings site lets people who are really fanatical Vikings fans get premium content, more columnists, things like that, for a charge of $5.95 for 3 months. But again, I think the idea that pay for access will actually sustain news gathering operations is probably pretty much wishful thinking. As mainstream news is finding it harder and harder to cover their local communities and provide the national and international reporting they used to support, new initiatives are coming along to try to fill that void. And for all the disruption that the internet has brought to the mainstream news business, it is the internet that's making it possible these projects to support the generation of independent, in-depth, and high-quality journalism. The old saw is that freedom of the press belonged to those who owned the press. Now the cost of entry into the business of publication requires just a computer. The part that is the most expensive is funding the work of the professional journalists who produce high-quality journalism. And here are some of the new initiatives that are being tried. One of the most cited new initiatives is right here in our own backyard, MinnPost. How many of you have ever gone to MinnPost? Okay, how many of you are subscribers? Good, okay. This is a not-for-profit enterprise providing high-quality regional journalism on the web. They had startup funding from major donors and foundations, but they hope that membership fees will make the operation sustainable by 2012. They have more than 1,200 people that have signed up as members during the first 15 months, with donations ranging from $10 a year to $20,000. Were you the $20,000 one? Yeah, okay. No, okay. Can I borrow some money? No. Joel Kramer, the publisher of MinnPost, has a goal of having most of the readers also being subscribers, but currently only about 7% of their readers are actually donating money. They are not trying to replicate the local newspaper coverage. They have little to nothing about sports or business, for example. They are more interested in providing analysis on community issues than they are in doing beat reporting. They have a staff of veteran local reporters and columnists, and they see themselves as filling a void in in-depth coverage of local policy. The Voice of San Diego is another of those local reporting initiatives that started with foundation funding, but hopes to move to a membership model. And as you can see in all of these, the donate now, please, is pretty prominent up there near the banner. There's the donate now. Okay, the Texas Tribune, this is a brand new startup that has actually been funded by venture capitalists. So some people who think that there may, in fact, be some investment potential in news. They're intending to fill the void that they see in state government reporting, and so their focus is going to be on Texas state government. Now, another way that people are trying to gauge the community's interest in supporting in-depth local reporting is called Spot Us, spot.us. Their model is to seek contributions for covering a specific story that a reporter might come up with. Or somebody in the community can suggest a story that needs to be covered. The reporter will say, I'm going to need, $1,500 to be able to go spend the time that I need to be able to cover this story. And then they wait until the thermometer, fills up to the bulb, and then they can go off and do this funded individual story. Now, on the national reporting level, there's ProPublica. They describe themselves on their website as an independent, nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. This is what they say. We focus exclusively on truly important stories, stories with moral force. We do this by producing journalism that shines a light on exploitation of the weak by the strong and on the failures of those in power to vindicate the trust placed in them. Paul Steger, the former managing editor of the Wall Street Journal, is the editor-in-chief for ProPublica, where he oversees a newsroom of 32 working journalists, all of them dedicated to investigative reporting on stories with significant potential for major impact. One of the things that they do, too, is essentially provide these stories as open source content. If they've reported a story, they will collaborate with a major news organization to help with the distribution and make sure these important stories are seen. Now, original funding for ProPublica was by the Sandler Foundation, but others have joined the effort to support in-depth, independent investigative reporting. Now let's go international. At the Global Post, the focus is on filling the gap in international news coverage now that so many mainstream newspapers have shut down their bureaus overseas. They have 65 correspondents in 50 countries with a goal to offer a depth, breadth, and quality of original international reporting that has mostly vanished from newspapers and television screens. They say that we are the leading edge of what we hope and believe will become a new flowering of journalism in the digital age, building new models of financial support and accumulating loyal users through a focused mission built around quality, service, accountability, and interaction with readers. They have a three-pronged business model: advertising, syndication and sale to other publications around the world, and the creation of an elite paid membership that they called Passport. It has a higher level of service that carries a membership fee in exchange for premium content. So unlike some of these other initiatives, the Global Post operates as a for-profit enterprise, believing that that's the best way to sustain business. And one of the things that they actually are using their very well-qualified reporting workforce for is to help these people that might buy a Passport membership to maybe get some investigation done on a particular area that is of interest to that person. So in some ways, it's almost acting as a personalized investigative team. And then there's Global Voices. This is a really interesting one. And you'll notice I haven't talked too much about, Web 2.0 and citizen journalism and all those kinds of things. That's warrants a whole nother kind of talk. But this Global Voices, I think, is an interesting model in that it's not a community of journalists. It's not hiring, highly qualified veteran laid-off journalists like a lot of these others are. What they're doing, it's building a community around more than 200 bloggers around the world who work together to bring translations and reports from blogs and citizen media everywhere, with emphasis on voices that are not ordinarily heard in international mainstream media. So essentially they have, rather than a staff of reporters, Global Voices is relying on volunteer authors and part-time editors to harvest interesting stories from blogs around the world. Global Voices funding has come from educational institutions like the Berkman Center at Harvard, news organizations like Reuters, and foundation funding from the MacArthur Foundation. And then this one is really interesting to me. Another way that people are trying to make sure that specialty reporting that might not get funded in mainstream media anymore continues. In this case, it's the in-depth coverage of healthcare policy and politics. Kaiser Health News's goal is to provide new opportunities for healthcare journalists to produce in-depth work and a new vehicle to distribute it through collaborations with major news organizations and through their website. The Kaiser Health News is a major program of the Kaiser Family Foundation, which gets its money from the Kaiser Permanente. Yeah. So this is one of those ones that, you know, sometimes can make journalists feel a little bit itchy, but I think that they are, you know, staying removed, and they really are trying to support high-quality health reporting. And then finally, I want to talk about a couple of government initiatives that are developing. The government is addressing the news industry crisis because they understand that without independent journalism, you cannot have an informed electorate, and without an informed electorate, our form of government simply won't work. So one of the things that they're floating is this idea of the L3C, the Limited Liability, Low Profit Corporation. Now, historically, because newspapers were commercially owned and take advertising, they couldn't claim nonprofit status. This law will allow the establishment of a low-profit, nonprofit hybrid entity. The entity would be a low-profit company with charitable or educational goals and some return for investors, you know, maybe around 3% instead of the 20% or so that newspaper investors have expected over the years. The social benefit, educational, and social responsibility features play to the newspapers, hopefully continuing and improving their role as public advocates and leaders of public debate. Now, one of the downsides of this, can anybody guess what one of the downsides of this might be? If the newspaper is a nonprofit? Huh? Low salaries. Yeah, that would be a downside for the reporters for sure. Anybody else? What can nonprofits not do? They can't advertise. Nope. They can't endorse candidates. They can't, you know, they can't endorse. So this may be, you know, a good thing. maybe a bad thing, but it would be a change if they went to this sort of a status. Now, Congress has recently been holding hearings about the news industry. Apparently, one idea that's coming up from the talks is to make the Corporation for Public Broadcasting commit the funds that they give to local public television and insist that those funds be used for local reporting. So instead of using the money to buy programming and, you know, let's see another six-part series of Jane Austen's wonderful work, they need to use the money to support local reporting in their communities. Paul Steiger, the editor-in-chief of ProPublica, gave testimony to the Federal Trade Commission workshop in the news media, that they just had a workshop on the news media a few days ago. And I like what he said here. He said, the process of finding and communicating what we used to call news may no longer require newspapers, at least not as we have known them. As seven-day-a-week, econ-paper compendiums of new information on a broad range of subjects. But the process will still require journalism and journalists to smoke out the most difficult-to-report situations, to test glib assertions against the facts, to probe for the carefully contrived hoax. These are reporting activities that take a great deal of time, money, and skill. Now, some of these approaches that people are taking to support new ways to ensure this kind of journalism is going to continue to be available, they will not be viable. They're not going to be sustainable. We don't really know what the new model or models for journalism will be. All I know is that we want to make sure that the light that journalists shine on the important issues and stories of the day is not turned off. Let's talk.
Thank you. There's lots to think about there. Where do you want to start? Can I ask you a question since I've got the mic, and then I'll hand it over to the front row here. Your work in the School of Journalism here at the university, I'm really curious about how the students look at this industry and what's driving them and their interests here.
Well, one of the things that we've said for years is we're not in the School of Newspapers. We're in the School of Journalism. And the kinds of skills that are taught to be a good journalist, clear writing, careful evaluation of information, ability to glean and ask good questions of sources, all those kinds of things are going to be useful skills in a lot of different areas. And my feeling, frankly, is that the big shift that's happening in journalism schools is that we're going to have to move away from it being a program where we prepare people to go to a corporation that they're going to work at for 35 years and then get a nice watch and everybody will, you know, thank them for their good work. Instead, it's going to be more of a craft school. I have a son that went to Columbia College in Chicago for his theater degree. You know, he learned acting skills, and he's certainly not getting a 9-to-5 job from that. But this is where he wants to ply his craft. And in that school, they prepared him on how to audition, how to manage your finances between gigs, as well as honing the craft of acting. And I think that that's part of what we're going to have to do in journalism schools, help people that want to be journalists, who want to tell these important stories, to be able to be entrepreneurial and to learn how to cobble together a career in the kind of area that they want to work in. But it's not going to be, you know, go work for Gannett for 35 years.
Are they passionate about it?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, one of the things that's very cool, a lot of these kids, because there is now such a toolbox that journalists can work with video and data visualization, you know, and flash presentations of stories, a lot of the students are so excited about the potential for telling stories beyond, you know, 18 inches of well-crafted text.
Question in the front here.
Well, I guess my question was somewhat related to Mary's, and that relates to with the dramatic change downward in the outlook for newspapers. What's happened to the schools of journalism?
Well, it's very odd. The School of Journalism at the University of Minnesota is journalism, advertising, and public relations. And usually the students split about one-third, one-third, one-third. We have more undergraduate majors than any other school in the College of Liberal Arts. We've even surpassed psychology, which normally was the highest enrollment. So there has been no less demand for, you know, or interest in these careers. So, like I said, I think part of what we need to respond to is the need for helping them figure out ways that they could actually thrive in an environment that's changed a great deal in the last 10 years.
We've got a question right here in the middle.
With newspapers, it seems like there's always been an expectation of some validating of the facts. Now, with the internet, there's absolutely no accountability whatsoever. Do you think there's any possibility that we might see a backlash at some point, with people finally getting tired of just seeing so much garbage and never knowing if something is valid or not?
Well, I think that
Is the sound carrying okay?
You got the question? Yeah.
Oh, do you want me to repeat it?
No, I think they got it.
I think that has already happened. And I think that people are still going to sort of trusted sources. If you ask somebody if you are wanting to follow some particular news story, they'll usually say, yes, I go to the Washington Post, or I always go to the CNN website, or something like that. They'll identify a source. One of the things that concerns me is that one of the things that's interesting is more and more newspaper websites find that the entry point into their website is straight to a story that somebody has found in a Google search. So it's not like they're going to the home page of the Star Tribune to see what kind of stories have been covered. They're doing a search on a story, getting a link, and then going to the website. So I'm kind of contradicting myself actually saying what I just said, because I think one of the things that's a problem is a lot of people do just, you know, do a search on something and Google sends them somewhere. When we started, before the talk started, we were, a couple of us were talking in the audience, and she was mentioning, what's your name?
Roxanne.
Yeah, Roxanne was saying that she heard somebody from Google, the president of Google, talking about what's going to be the real important skill is critical thinking and in-depth media literacy, so that you know when you pull something up, you can quickly say, you know, who is this person telling me this? Why are they telling me this? And how is it that they know what they know? You know, if you can answer those three questions pretty confidently, then you can use that information, I think, with some confidence.
Right here in the front.
Would you want to talk about Minnesota Public Radio's expansion into news, and do they think that they're going to be the avenue of the future rather than online stuff?
No, I don't want to talk about that. No, I think that certainly spurred a lot of controversy. They had a gathering a couple of weeks ago where they had representatives from the major local media to sort of talk about what their idea is around really shoring up this local coverage. I think they're another one where they have done a tremendous job of doing some local coverage, but a lot of their programming is, you know, national and programs that they buy that aren't necessarily local coverage. So I think that's part of what the stake in the ground that they're doing is saying, you know, there's a void here, and it's a void that we're going to try to fill. One of the things that I think is really interesting about what Minnesota Public Radio is doing, is anybody part of their Public Insight Network? A couple of you? Just you? There's only one? A couple of people? You too. You contribute. You join. Good. Okay. That is a real interesting enterprise that they're doing to really try to. It's not citizen journalism, which I think in a lot of cases is not going to be a viable way to essentially outsource reporting. It is a way, though, to connect the expertise of that every one of us have expertise in some area, and to be able to tap into it to make their reporting more informed and more relevant to the people in the community. So I think that's really strong. They're also great at getting grants, you know, which is going to be an important skill, I think, for news organizations to be able to find the funding to do the work they want to do.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the difference between citizen journalism and public insight?
Okay. Well, the notion of citizen journalism is that, you know, you could deputize everybody in the community, essentially, to go out and be reporters. You know, we don't have enough feet on the street. So every one of you, you know, you go to the PTA meeting. Why don't you report on the PTA for us? You go down the street and you see a new restaurant opening. Tell us about it. And so the whole most websites now have some way to easily contribute your pictures or your videos or be part of a citizen reporting network. In fact, there's one thing that CNN does called iReport. Let me see if I can go on and get it. Can I get back to the web?
Isn't this magic?
This was very, very controversial. So this is actually, it's kind of interesting because for a while they didn't even put the CNN part on there. And their kind of tagline was, you know, unfiltered, unedited news by you. And this was their citizen reporting gathering space. The idea, though, that I mean, one of the things that's really amazing about the world now is that everybody is walking around with the tools to be able to capture what's happening right now. I mean, if you're walking down the street and you see two cars, you know, starting to go together, and you pull out your phone and you shoot a little video, you may be the only eyewitness, and you can sell it, you know, to the news stations. The first reporting of the plane landing in the river in New York, the pictures were pictures that just folks, you know, took. And I think that this is a tremendous way, but I don't to be able to get really on the spot as it's happening news. But I would not say that those people are citizen reporters. They are, you know, they just happen to have been there and had the equipment to capture it. So the citizen reporter is this idea that the newsroom can rely on the efforts of volunteer reporters to fill the void that they're not able to fill because there's fewer and fewer of them out there to cover the stories.
And then the public insight journalists are experts.
No, the public insight journalism is a database that people volunteer to be part of. They fill out a profile about the things that they're interested in, some of the work experiences they've had, places they live. What kind of things did they ask you in the... Oh, okay.
So he knew that I had been working in the College of Education and Human Development, that I knew a lot of people in education, and so he contacted me and asked me if I wanted to join as someone who knew a lot about the educational scene in the state.
Good. And so what they'll do is actually, I mean, you'll get things in your email box saying, hey, we're getting ready to start thinking about a story about, you know, educational policy. Would wonder what you, if you've got some angles that you think might be interesting for us to cover. In fact, they're spreading the sort of news agenda and the, you know, the editorial discussion to include citizens that they know have an expertise that's not always tapped.
Let's go to the back here.
I just have a quick question about the journalism students that come to you. They must be privy to the state of newspaper and traditional journalism. How do they see their futures? Do they think they're all competing for the last remaining newspaper jobs, or do they think I'm going to break away and start my own blog and hit it big and everyone's going to love it? I'm going to make money with advertising on my blog.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and one of the things that I think is something that we don't do very well at the journalism school is actually track where our alumni end up. But a lot of them do start off in small-town newspapers. And those, frankly, the small town newspapers are still, you know, very viable businesses because they do have that sort of captured local business that relies on their distribution to get, you know, the advertising out. The other things that are starting to happen is a lot of them are getting more skilled in, I mean, one of the things that we've also said is stop identifying your journalism aspirations by some medium. Don't say, I want to be a newspaper reporter or I want to be a television reporter. You want to be a reporter. And to be a reporter these days, you're going to have to be able to go across all of the different channels and be able to produce the right kind of story for that particular channel. And so I think the designation that we're going more for is, do you want to focus on storytelling with words or storytelling with media? And in fact, there is a third category that some journalism schools are focusing on, which is the journalist programmer. And at Northwestern University, they have a program where they're taking undergraduate computer science students, giving them a free ride in the journalism school to get a master's degree, because they understand that part of our future is going to be around figuring out ways to use information technologies to tell stories in ways that you simply couldn't before, and that probably nobody else will, you know, make the effort to do. So I think that there's some real changes in the traditional trajectories of journalists. But, yeah, frankly, right now, the best thing that most journalism students get is an internship, which is a great foot in the door.
We have a question over here, then.
I think one of the nicest or best things that MinPost does is to have their own reporter in Washington, D.C., and when an issue comes up, she interviews all of the Minnesota delegation to get their opinions and the subject, which is something that really is very valuable, I think, to any Minnesota resident.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that most newspapers used to have. There was somebody in the Washington Bureau that could pay attention to what the concerns would be of that local community. And that's one of the things that, you know, got shuttered. So it is a terrific thing, I think, that MinnPost has realized that that's a very important part of news coverage for a community. Thanks for pointing that out.
Did you notice on that screenshot that you had of MinnPost, the ad in the upper right-hand corner was from our college, Continuing
Yay!
Education,
okay.
Promoting our information session December, I don't know, 6th, 7th, something like that, for our degree programs.
Yes, good.
So, and we just got 280 more eyeballs on that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Is it 280 or is it 560? How do you count it?
I don't know. Well, if you're counting eyeballs, then it's the 560.
So at any rate.
Unless people
ad
were...
was a big... It can raise their price. All right. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, right here. I'll be right there with you.
Well, I perhaps am in the dark ages, but one of the concerns I have is the amount of time that it takes to sort through all of these various sources and then to try to get a decent scan.
Yep.
In a newspaper, you could just open it up and scan through to see what you're interested in. You might find things that you weren't interested in, which otherwise now you would miss. So I'd like... understand that. Perhaps I'm a dinosaur, but maybe there's another way to look at it.
I've got a good little thing for that, too. If I hope I can find it.
I mean, if you read your paper and drink a cup of coffee in the morning, it's how you start your day, right?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is really going to be a big change that's going to happen, because I personally have a hard time with news websites. They are very hard, and the main thing that's a real problem is that the newspaper is a medium that is tailor-made for browsing and for serendipity. You know, you're not really after anything. Maybe you want to find out what the weather's going to be, you know, or what, you know, the comic strip is up to today. But for the most part, you're just welcome the surprise of what gets covered.
You know, you're trying to wake up and not have to talk to anybody, right?
Yeah.
Is that what we're doing?
You're hiding. But online, you go to a website because you've got something that you want to find out about. I mean, you're very much more strategic and directed when you're going online. And that's one of the things I find very difficult on online news sites. Sometimes it's really hard to find what it is that you're wanting to be specific about. Let me see if I can find this.
This is the subliminal ad here.
Okay. This is the must-have handheld accessory of 2009. This is how you open it. This is the amazing 26-inch panoramic matte CMYK full-color display. And these are the PhotoReal 3D graphics. This is the very best in news, not waiting for it to download, not squinting at sports on a tiny screen, not turning it sideways to see it better. And these are the 7 free inbuilt games complete with Pentouch interface, including Crossword and Double Dooku. This is how easy it is to share content with friends, and all with a guarantee that you'll never lose reception again. There are no hidden charges. There's no contract needed either. This is the amazing 100% recyclable, no substitute for it, Sun newspaper, version 4.0.
One of the things that I think is going to be the next exciting development is actually when we get to, and I've been hearing about it for years, digital paper. There is going to be digital paper. There will, in my lifetime. And it's going to be like this, and you're going to be able to update, and it'll, you know, if you want to read in that kind of format, I think you'll be able to do it. So, and how many of you have a Kindle? A couple of you? It's, I mean, there was a publisher in Iceland who did some calculations and figured out that it would be cheaper to buy a Kindle for every one of his subscribers and then teach them how to download the digital paper every day than to pay for the trucks and the paper and the ink, you know, and all of that that it takes to actually go and, you know, deliver a newsprint product. And so I think some of this kind of thing, as some of these appliances that allow us to deliver news get cheaper and cheaper, that, you know, again, we may be moving away from a newsprint model. Or if you like that format, you're going to pay a premium. I had friends here from Denmark, and we went to go, you know, buy the newspaper, and they could not believe it was 50 cents or whatever it was. That, you know, in Denmark, you pay $5 for the daily paper, you know, and you also have, you know, a good deal of choice. But so they, if that's the format that you want, you know, you'll have to pay a premium, because that is really the largest part of the expense of the news business.
Nora, we have a question over here on the left.
Me? Yeah.
The mic's right here. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just curious if you know of any, what is being done to educate the younger generation as far as when you talk about critical thinking skills. And I'm just thinking about my kids who aren't that old. I mean, I have one who's a freshman in college who every week, you know, they would have current events and you'd have to bring an article from the newspaper. And, you know, you would have to talk about it and what it was about. And I don't even know if you can even ask that anymore because so many people don't have newspapers. But so how is there any strategies or any talk about going on to educating our youth who will not be relying on newspapers to get their news?
Well, media literacy is a very big element in a lot of different kinds of courses. But you make a very good point about the whole thing of, you know, bringing a newspaper article from the newspaper. They don't get the newspaper. I gave an assignment. I teach the Introduction to Mass Communication course, and I gave an assignment for them to look at a television program from three different channels, you know, especially, you know, one maybe general channel, two specialty channels, and really look at the advertising that went around the programming to really be able to talk about, okay, who's the audience here and why are they using these kind of commercials to attract them? What do you know? And they said, you know, what is the thing, Hulu? Has anybody heard of Hulu? Yeah. They said, can I watch it on Hulu? Can I watch a TV show on Hulu? Which is a TV show download program website. And because they said, I don't have a television. They don't watch television anymore. That, of course, negated the whole idea of the ads wrapped around, because on Hulu, all you get is the program. So this idea of this presumption of how people are consuming media anymore is impossible to really gauge. I've also found that with listening to the radio, you know, they don't listen to the radio. They've got Pandora, they've got whatever they've got on their iPhone or their iPods, and the idea of appointment media is just beyond them.
You're really in a hot field, aren't you? Wow, this is changing all the time. We have another question back here.
Is this a phenomena that we're seeing in the United States worldwide, and is it as precipitous as it is in the United States, for example, in Western Europe?
You know, I can't speak to that really well informed. It's not something that I've been tracking or anything. I know that there are the similar kinds of issues, but in a lot of cases, there's better, you know, government subsidies and things like that for news publication. But I really shouldn't say more than that because I can't. I mean, I don't really follow news economics internationally. Does anybody have a sense of that? What's going on in Europe? Sorry about that.
Let me try to
give me your email and I'll I'll research it. I'll send you something.
Do you have some response to that? Yeah, let me bring you Mike. This is public.
I know, I'm outsourcing my citizen presenter.
Yeah. My two favorite sites are the BBC online and the Times of London, both of which are designed to be able to browse. which we just talked about here. You can click on the international, and you get all this international stuff. You can then go to the Europeans. You can go to the science and those kinds of things. The BBC is, and it clearly is that the Brits are moving in that direction, both for both of their great prestigious news-gathering organizations.
I read an article not too long ago about the newspaper industry internationally, and I think it was in a newspaper that I read it. And it indicated that in Europe, at least, newspaper reading is much, much higher than it is in the United States.
No, that's a very good point. And a lot of that's because of the transportation system. You know, you buy the newspaper, you get on the train, you take the train, but you can't read your newspaper while you're driving in your car trying to get to work. And so also big cities. I mean, a lot of the big cities, Chicago, things like that, they have the Red Eye, some of those free newspapers that are really intended for subway travelers, and they are advertising vehicles. You know, they are really trying to be able to have space to sell to advertisers. So again, it's not subscriptions that are going to support news organizations. They're still trying to figure out advertising.
You can't read the newspaper in the car because you're too busy texting, right?
Right.
There's a question over here now.
You know, we've all grown up with reading the same newspapers, same magazines, listening to the same news broadcasts on radio and television. And now we have all these different sources, but isn't this compartmentalized, selective look at different websites by individuals, doesn't this suggest further divisiveness and compartmentalized public goals and less factual knowledge, and isn't this bad for democracy and representative government?
Well, you've really hit on one of the things that a lot of people are very concerned about, is that you can put such blinders around what you're interested in knowing about, and you will go to those sites that confirm what you already believe, that all you're going to be doing is getting reinforced with the things that you already know or think, and that is a real problem. one of the, you know, that serendipity that we talked about before with the newspaper, you know, I'm not really interested in outer space travel, but boy, there's an interesting story that I, you know, just happened to see, and now I know a little bit about what's going on in outer space. And I wouldn't do that if all I've got is my news filter set up to be about those things that I'm interested in. I think that's a real issue, but in some ways it's like what we've always had. I mean, especially when they're, one of the other things about Europe, there's usually multiple newspapers, and they are very overt about what their political leaning is. We are the Social Democrat paper, you know, we are the Republican paper, whatever. And in those places, people didn't, you know, buy all three papers so they could get a wide range of opinions. They pick the paper that mostly, you know, fits their viewpoint. So this may be something that's always been sort of the case, but now we can really track it. You know, we can really see that that's the case. This is one of the things that I think is also interesting about what's going on with newspapers online, is that the newspaper can now see what it is that people read. You know, what do they click on? And a lot of them are making editorial decisions around those things that are the most popular of the hits. The trouble, and one of the things that I think is funny, is that they sort of wax nostalgic for the days when everybody picked up the newspaper and read it, you know, top to bottom, side to side, from front to back. And I'm sorry, that was never the case. There, every one of you has a section that you just put to the side, you know. So it was never the case that everybody always read all of your wonderful journalism. But now we can tell that they're not reading all of your wonderful journalism.
Nora, how should we think about this news this morning that Comcast now has bought really a controlling stake, I think, isn't it 51% of NBC Universal from General Electric?
I haven't really gotten to read much about it yet. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the concerns are. I mean, General Electric, owned TV stations and things like that before. So I don't know if I have a really informed comment to make about that. What are some of the issues that you guys see it raising?
I think my concern is that it just further accelerates the trend towards the consumption of pseudo news as entertainment. It's really not news. Comcast is looking for content that appeals to the popular audience, and that will push out what I consider news to be, which are facts, not opinions, mm-hmm. and not entertainment.
Well, and I would say, now that I think about it for a second, one of my big concerns would probably be this notion of net neutrality. And where in the past, anybody that had an internet access, you essentially had the same kind of access to all the programming or, access to the websites. The net neutrality issue is one where the people that own the pipes, Comcast, would maybe charge a premium to certain kinds of suppliers of information to get their information delivered quickly. And, if you don't have that premium to pay, you're going to be on the slow lane of the internet. And so, now that I think about it, that may be one of the areas where a communications company like Comcast could be shoring up more of this sort of net neutrality issue.
Interesting. Excuse me. Any other questions or comments that are burning out? Let me get the mic right here.
Well, I really like the newspaper, but I have a question. I was gone for a week. I come back. My husband's got all this stuff stacked up. Half of it's want ads. Has anybody analyzed the impact on businesses for the want ad, the advertisement that comes in newspaper? How will we get that? I don't frankly want it, but many people do. And it obviously impacts business significantly.
Well, there was that statistic about the want ads, the revenue from want ads just plummeting in the first quarter because there's no jobs, But what has been replacing it is things like Monster, which frankly, newspapers lost a big opportunity. They thought that they had it set with their classified ads, that worked great for years. They didn't try early on to figure out a way to be the Craigslist for their community. And so Craigslist came along free, instead of, paying $35 for a garage ad sale that you had to do in the newspaper, or you're trying to sell a television and then you sell it, but you had to buy a 3-day run, so then you have to pick up the phone for the next 3 days. They didn't think of what the potential of publishing news and information in this digital kind of format would allow them to do. And in a lot of cases, for a long time, the news website was what was referred to as shovelware. We shoveled what we put in the newspaper onto the website. And in fact, that's not necessarily what you want to get on a website, is what was in the newspaper. You want to have some kind of functions. So, classified advertising for want ads, there's a million places that people go. This raises another issue, though, along with net neutrality, that sort of digital divide. If you don't have Comcast access and a computer in your house, you're tromping down to the public library to get access to a computer to be able to get on and see those classified ads. But,
Nora, did you have a question over there?
I have a question for you, Nora. It seems like one of the great promises of being able to read newspapers online was the interactivity. And yet the comments that come after follow a story have not always lived up to what we had hoped would be a civil, informed discussion. Do you have any comments about the quality of commenting on online newspapers?
Yeah. This whole idea of the forums and the comments areas, I think one of the problems there, again, was a lot of newspaper development online was done, because everybody else was doing it, but they didn't really know what to do with it. And one of the early issues with that was actually legal. If you did not edit those comments, then you essentially were safe from being held liable for the comments. If you edited it, then it became part of your content, and you would, in fact, have liability. So that kept people, you know, sort of hands off. Okay, we'll make the space open for you. It's town hall. You know, I don't go around in the town hall and say, no, you can't say that. It was basically an open forum. And frankly, most of them are very badly run. The other thing about forums is if there's, you know, 100 people that go to a forum, 94 of them never comment. You know, 3 comment a couple of times, and there's 1 or 2 that are the ones that are always going to be the posters. That is almost an equation that fits any of these sort of contribution type sites. So it's not like you're getting a widely representative section of opinions and voices in a community. You're getting those few people that want to get on there and rant. One of the things that I find interesting, though, is some places like the BBC or The Guardian, I think, was the one that was, they really use that as a content area, and they cull through it and find interesting comments and use those interesting comments as part of the, you know, sort of sidebar information about a story. But that requires a sort of curation function that, again, it's harder and harder to do with fewer and fewer people trying to cover as much, you know, community life as ever.
Well, Nora, this has been really fascinating tonight, and I think as educators, we're always talking about teaching critical thinking and helping students develop critical thinking skills, and I'm kind of re-energized about how important that is, again, in this kind of world, and it's taken on a whole new meaning as a result of listening to you tonight. So please join me in thanking Nora Paul.
Thank you.